When we were together 2 weeks ago, we completed a very long series through the book of Acts. And you may remember that prior to Acts, we had worked through the book of Joshua. And here, we're going to really pick up where that series had ended. In the last chapter of Joshua, we read, "Now it came to pass after these things that Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died, being 110 years old. And they buried him within the border of his inheritance at Timnath-Serah, which is in the mountain of Ephraim, on the north side of Mount Gaash." That near the end of the book of Joshua. Now the book of Judges begins with these words: "Now after the death of Joshua." So Judges picks up where Joshua left off. In Joshua, we saw the Israelites conquer the land of Canaan in fulfillment of divine prophecy given to Abraham. Joshua was the great leader of the conquest, and the question before us is, who will arise as the next great leader of Israel? Well, as the plural noun in the book's title indicates, we will encounter a series of leaders who will come and go as we work through the pages of the book of Judges. Now, to get our chronological bearings, Joshua died about 1390 B.C., Moving forward, Saul was anointed the first king of Israel around 1050 B.C., and the book of Judges covers the roughly 300 years between those two events. So in these chapters, we're going to be reviewing about 300 years of Israel's history prior to the monarchy. And tonight, we're going to begin to look at the introduction to the book that runs from chapter 1, verse 1 to chapter 2, verse 5. We're not going to get through all of that tonight, but I want to give you the outline of that, which we will begin tonight and pick up next week. It has three basic sections: Yahweh's guidance and promise in the first two verses of chapter 1, the response of Israel, the rest of chapter 1, verses 3 through 36, and Yahweh's evaluation in chapter 2, verses 1 through 5. Now, the response of Israel is narrated first of the tribe of Judah, then Joseph, and then the other tribes. And tonight, we are going to get as far as the response of Israel by Judah. So we're going to get partway through our outline. I'm sure next time we will be able to complete this introduction to the book. But begin with Yahweh's guidance and promise in the first two verses. "Now after the death of Joshua, it came to pass that the children of Israel asked Yahweh, saying, 'Who shall be first to go up for us against the Canaanites to fight against them?' And Yahweh said, 'Judah shall go up. Indeed, I have delivered the land into his hand.'" Now, to understand this question of the Israelites, we must remember that while they had achieved major victory in the conquest of Canaan, they had not entirely expelled the inhabitants of that land. In his farewell address, Joshua had instructed them, "See, I have divided to you by lot these nations that remain, to be an inheritance for your tribes from the Jordan, with all the nations that I have cut off as far as the great sea westward. And Yahweh your God will expel them from before you and drive them out of your sight. So you shall possess their land, and Yahweh your God, as Yahweh your God has promised you." So at the time of Joshua's death, there were original inhabitants of Canaan who were still there, who still needed to be driven out. And the promise was that the Lord would expel them so that they might fully possess the land. Now, in military terms, we would say that what was required was a mopping up operation. In a large part, the enemy had been defeated, but there were troops behind that needed to be expelled in order for Israel to solidify its possession of the land. Now, with that in mind, they have a question for Yahweh. "Who shall be the first to go up against the Canaanites to fight against them?" Now, the language used here, "the children of Israel asked Yahweh," suggests that there was some kind of formal ritual involved. It might have involved the Urim and Thummim on the breastplate of the high priest. That had been used in the appointment of Joshua as Moses' successor back in Numbers 27. There have been other instances where Israel sought the Lord's guidance. We're not told exactly how they did. And so this may have come through that. It may have come from some other means, but it was a divine answer to their question. Yahweh said, Judah shall go up. Indeed, I have delivered the land into his hand. Now, this makes sense that Judah would be leading this charge because Judah was the royal tribe. Jacob announced this in his blessing upon his sons. In Genesis 49:10, Jacob says, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from beneath his feet until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the people. Judah is the royal tribe from which David will come, and from which the greater David, the Lord Jesus, would come. Judah's leadership here foreshadows its special role in God's unfolding plan of redemption. Now, Yahweh's guidance about the tribe of Judah, which we can really understand coming from the Lord as a command, is accompanied by a promise. Indeed, I have delivered the land into his hand. So while Israel will need to engage in battle, it is the Lord who would assure them of victory, just as they had already experienced in the battles of the initial conquest. Well, that leads us, secondly, to the response of Israel that occupies the rest of the chapter. And we're going to begin tonight by looking at the large section, verses 3 through 21, that talk about the tribe of Judah's response. Verse 3, so Judah said to Simeon his brother, come up with me to my allotted territory that we may fight against the Canaanites, and I will likewise go with you to your allotted territory. And Simeon went with him. Now it seems that Israel's off to a good start in the book of Judges. They consult with the Lord, a wise thing to do. They receive his guidance as a command. They hear a promise of success, and now they're following through in obedience based on the word of the Lord. Now, as we will see, this good start does not indicate everything that lies ahead in the book, but we do begin here with Judah. Now, Judah's choice of Simeon here is not random. Simeon and Levi had brought shame upon Jacob when they deceived the men of Shechem into circumcising themselves to form a bond with Israel after the Dinah incident. While the men of Shechem were still in pain, Simeon and Levi had slaughtered them in revenge for what had happened to their sister. Their blessing from Jacob was very different from that of Judah. Jacob says in 49:5-7, Simeon and Levi are brothers. Instruments of cruelty are in their dwelling place. Let not my soul enter their council. Let not my honor be united to their assembly. For in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they hamstrung an ox. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. And so, in judgment upon their wickedness, the tribes of both Simeon and Levi would not receive the full tribal allotments that the others received in the land of Canaan. Now, we know that for Levi, this sort of became a blessing because the Levites were set aside as priests. And the priests lived in all the allotments scattered throughout the land where they could minister there and serve in that responsibility. Simeon, on the other hand, had found refuge within the inheritance of Judah. So Simeon did not have their own allotment, but Judges 19 tells us that they were allowed to have a part of the land allotted to Judah. I read part of that, Judges 19, beginning at verse 1. The second lot came out for Simeon, for the tribe of the children of Simeon according to their families, and their inheritance was within the inheritance of the children of Judah. And then there's a long list of cities and villages that were counted for them. This was the inheritance of the tribe of the children of Simeon according to their families. The inheritance of the children of Simeon was included in the share of the children of Judah, for the share of the children of Judah was too much for them. Therefore, the children of Simeon had their inheritance within the inheritance of their people. So while the tribe of Simeon did not have a full allotment, Yahweh graciously placed them within the expansive territory of Judah. And so it's against that backdrop that we read verse 3. So Judah said to Simeon his brother, come up with me to my allotted territory that we may fight against the Canaanites, and I will likewise go with you to your allotted territory. And Simeon went with him. Simeon had been shown grace through Judah, and now was willing to join his brother in clearing the Canaanites from their allotted territory, first Judah and then Simeon's. And we hear some of the details of their battles, verses 4 through 7. Then Judah went up, and Yahweh delivered the Canaanites and the Perizzites into their hand, and they killed 10,000 men at Bezek. And they found Adoni Bezek in Bezek and fought against him, and they defeated the Canaanites and the Perizzites. Perizzites. Then Adoni Bezek fled, and they pursued him and caught him and cut off his thumbs and big toes. And Adoni Bezek said, 70 kings with their thumbs and big toes cut off used to gather scraps under my table. As I have done, so God has repaid me. Then they brought him to Jerusalem, and there he died. Now note the opening words here in verse 4. Then Judah went up, and Yahweh delivered. And here's something we see over and over in Scripture. The Lord does it, but he does it through the faithful obedience of his people. Divine deliverance came, but it was with the obedient action of the tribe of Judah and implicitly here, Simeon. In other words, there was no presuming upon the Lord's promises. Rather, trust in his promises emboldened these tribes for action. Let go and let God is not a scriptural principle. It's not found in the Bible. It's very popular in our culture, but it's really not the recipe for obedience and blessing that we find in Scripture. Now, as in Joshua, we face major bloodshed here in Judges 1. And so the question arises, can we justify what modern people would label genocide? Well, we went into that in some depth. We won't repeat all of that that we talked about in Joshua. But of course we can when we see it in light of God's redemptive purposes. When Yahweh cut a covenant with Abram in Genesis 15, he promises Abram's descendants the land, saying, in the fourth generation they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. So during the 400 years, the tribes of Israel were in Egyptian captivity. The iniquity of the inhabitants of Canaan grew worse and worse until it reached the point that God punished them at the sword points of his people. The Israelite soldiers were obeying the command God had given through Moses, as we find it in Deuteronomy 20. We read there, but of the cities of these people, which Yahweh your God gives you as an inheritance, you shall let nothing that breathes remain alive, but you shall utterly destroy them, the Hittite and the Amorite and the Canaanite and the Perizzite and the Hivite and the Jebusite, just as Yahweh your God has commanded you, lest they teach you to do according to all their abominations, which they have done for their gods, and you sin against Yahweh your God. Now, just as God cleansed the world of wickedness by the flood in Noah's day, so he commanded his people to cleanse the land of wicked pagans, lest they themselves be led astray by them. The warning was, drive them out. If you don't drive them out, what's going to happen is you're going to start adopting some of their ways. You're going to start following their gods. You're going to abandon me, the true God. And so all the people in the land were placed under the ban. That is, they were to be utterly destroyed. Now, another way to look at this is that this judgment in history provides a preview of the judgment that will take place at the end of history. Yes, they killed 10,000 men at Bezek in obedience to Yahweh, and in doing so, they acted righteously. We need to be careful that we not become ashamed of our God and what he reveals to us in his word. There's an awful lot of doubt being cast upon this, especially God's character in light of these kinds of things in the Old Testament by so-called progressive Christians in our day. J. Gresham Machen wrote the book Christianity and Liberalism. And his point was, there's Christianity and there's liberalism, and they are two different things. And I think we could write Christianity and progressive Christianity today, and they are two different things. Because in the name of Christianity, there's a lot of people that are embarrassed by what the Bible teaches. Well, now we have an interesting narrative about Adoni Bezek. Bezek was a place, and Adoni means Lord. So where do you think Adoni Bezek would live? He would live in Bezek because he was the Lord of Bezek, an indication that was sort of a title. He was the ruler of that place. And the forces of Judah and Simeon fought against him, and we read of them. Then Adoni-Bezek fled, and they pursued him and caught him and cut off his thumbs and big toes. Just what you'd expect. Well, that may strike us as a rather strange form of punishment. Why cut off his thumbs and his big toes? Well, for one thing, I would challenge you to try to run in battle or hurl a spear or shoot an arrow without your thumbs and big toes. The fact is, you are largely incapacitated if you don't have those opposing digits. You would find it nearly impossible. Adoni-Bezek was stripped of his ability ever to wage battle again. Furthermore, he recognizes the justice in his punishment. And Adoni-Bezek said, 70 kings with their thumbs and big toes cut off used to gather scraps under my table. As I have done, so God has repaid me. Now, this is an example of what we call lex talionis, that is the law of retribution. It is commonly summarized as an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. It was a law that God gave to say the punishment is to fit the crime. Far from being an unreasonable thing, it actually put limits upon the punishment that could be given out. Well, in this case, we have a thumb for a thumb and a big toe for a big toe. Actually, a thumb for 70 thumbs. No, 140 thumbs and a big toe for 140 big toes, because you got two of each. What Adoni-Bezek gave out came back upon him. And again, he recognized this as a divine judgment. And his story ends, then they brought him to Jerusalem, and there he died. This ruler who had crippled 70 kings was himself crippled in the same way. And he was taken to the royal city, not as a great king, but as one who was defeated. And there King Yahweh had victory over him. Verse 8, now the children of Judah fought against Jerusalem and took it. They struck it with the edge of the sword and set the city on fire. Now Jerusalem originally lay in the territory of Benjamin, but it was most appropriate for the royal tribe of Judah to fight to take control of it. The Israelites knew of Jerusalem's royal association through the shadowy figure of Melchizedek, who had been its king and priest, and to whom Abraham had paid tithes. Now the royal tribe took this royal city, though, as we will see, it's later going to be taken by the Jebusites, who David would have to drive out. And fire is, it's, they set it on fire, which is an instrument of divine wrath and of cleansing, which was an appropriate thing to do as they took control of the royal city. Verse 9, and afterward the children of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites who dwelt in the mountains, in the south, and in the lowland. And this is a summary statement that basically tells you that the troops of Judah fought the Canaanites wherever they could be found. If they're in the mountains, we'll fight them there. If they're in the south, we'll fight them there. If they're in the lowland, we fight them there. And what we see again in these initial days is that Judah is being faithful to her divine mandate. Verse 10, then Judah went against the Canaanites who dwelt in Hebron. Now the name of Hebron was formerly Kirjath Arba, and they killed Shishai, Ahiman, and Talmai. Now these are very strange names, but there's actually a good bit here below the surface if you know something about the history. Hebron had been appointed as one of the cities of refuge in Joshua's time. And so by ridding it of Canaanites, it was thus being established as a place of sanctuary. And we're told that Hebron's former name was Kirjath Arba. And there's two possible meanings to this, both of which are likely true. Kirjath means city, and Arba means four. And some scholars think that that suggests that Hebron was sort of a metropolis that covered the territory that had originally been four separate towns, and they're all sort of together now in the city of Hebron. But we also learn in Joshua 14:15 that Arba was the name of a man. We read in that verse, and the name of Hebron formerly was Kirjath Arba. Arba was the greatest man among the Anakim. Now that should strike fear into you. Bev's got it. Bev's going like this. The Anakim were a race of giants, And if Arba was the greatest man among the Anakim, he must have been fearsome indeed. It may be in his honor that the original name of Hebron was Kirjath Arba, or as we might call it, Giant Town. And the forces of Judah were victorious in Giant Town because they killed Shishai, Ahiman, and Talmai. And Numbers 13:22 tells us that Shishai, Ahiman, and Talmai were descendants of Arba and were giants like him. Now you may recall that when Israel first came to the edge of the Promised Land and sent spies into the land to spy it out, to prepare for them to take it, 10 of the spies came back fearful. One of the main reasons they were fearful is that giants filled the land. But like faithful Joshua and Caleb before him, Judah would not be cowed by these giants. Yahweh granted victory over even the most challenging of foes. I think we need to remember this. Judah is not taking assessments. They're not taking battle assessments on the basis merely of their strength and the strength of the enemy. I mean, they could very well have been scared away. They had a promise from the Lord, and in faith, they were acting on that promise, trusting that he would grant them the victory. Verse 11, from there, they went against the inhabitants of Debir. The name of Debir was formerly Kirjath Sefer. Again, some significance to these words. The word Debir means word, and Kirjath Sefer means city of the book or city of the document. And it was likely an official repository of documents in Canaan. It was the archive of Canaanite civilization. It would have been well guarded, and in a sense, to destroy Kirjath Sefer was to wipe out Canaanite civilization, was to wipe its very records out. And so it was a strategic target as Israel was establishing full control of the land. Next, we have an ancient Near Eastern love story, but this comes by way of a flashback. Verses 12 through 15. Then Caleb said, "Whoever attacks Kirjath Sefer and takes it, to him I will give my daughter Aksah as wife." And Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, took it. So he gave him his daughter Aksah as wife. Now it happened, when she came to him, that she urged him to ask her father for a field. And she dismounted from her donkey, and Caleb said to her, "What do you wish?" So she said to him, "Give me a blessing. Since you have given me land in the south, give me also springs of water." And Caleb gave her the upper springs and the lower springs. Now this story had already been narrated, almost word for word, almost all the same details, back in Joshua chapter 15. So it is rather surprising that it reappears here, and we would wonder, why is that the case? Well, it could be that when he says, from there, they came against the inhabitants of Debir, his mind goes back to what has already happened at Debir. And so he rehearses that earlier history. Narrating the story again also brings to mind faithful Caleb, Caleb, who had had the faith to go against the giants in this time when the giants had been defeated. In any case, what happens is Caleb had offered his daughter Aksah as wife to the man who conquered Debir, Kirjath Sefer. Now that sounds very foreign to us. Maybe some of you young ladies here would not wish your father to say that I will provide my daughter as wife to the guy who does such and such. But actually, it was not only common in that day, but it was very wise on the part of Caleb. This was a highly fortified city. If a man was to lead the attack and gain victory over this city, he would have to be wise, strong, and he would have to be a man of God. Victory would only come as they trusted in the Lord. And as it turns out, his nephew Othniel does gain that victory and receives Aksah as his wife. And she shows wisdom in dealing with her father. When he asks what she wishes, she replies, "Give me a blessing. Since you have given me land in the south, give me also springs of water." Now, what's translated land in the south is literally Negev land. Now, that doesn't mean that she was literally living in the Negev desert, but it's a way to say what the land was like. Basically, she'd been given desert-like land. And so her request was for access to water, which is what they would need in that land. And we're told that Caleb gave her the upper springs and the lower springs. And this may be one of those cases, by mentioning both the upper and the lower, it sort of encompasses all and says, you can have access to all the water you need. I will ensure that you have that. And as a result of that blessing, she says it would be a blessing, the desert-like land will be able to be fruitful. Well, after that sort of flashback, we come back to the present, verses 16 through 21. Now the children of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, went up from the city of palms with the children of Judah into the wilderness of Judah, which lies in the south near Arad, and they went and dwelt among the people. The children of the Kenite, these were Midianites. They were children of Abraham, but they were not Israelites. Moses had married into a Kenite tribe presided over by his father-in-law, Jethro. And Moses had invited some of the Kenites to travel with them to the promised land, assuring them of safety. We read in Numbers 10, Now Moses said to Hobab, the son of Reuel, which is an alternate name for Jethro, the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law, we are setting out for the place which Yahweh said, I will give it to you. Come with us, and we will treat you well, for Yahweh has promised good things to Israel. And he said to him, I will not go, but I will depart to my own land and to my relatives. So Moses said, Please do not leave, inasmuch as you know how we are to camp in the wilderness, and you can be our eyes. And it shall be if you go with us. Indeed, it shall be that whatever good Yahweh will do to us, the same we will do to you. And what the sequel shows is that Moses was convincing, and some of these people came with them. We're told that they went up from the city of palms. The city of palms is Jericho. Remember that first city that was conquered in the conquest? They moved from Jericho into the wilderness of Judah. That is, into some of the territory that belonged to Judah. And these non-Israelites found a home there. And this is one of a number of those signs throughout the Old Testament of God's grace reaching out beyond Israel. And even through the great time in the wilderness and the conquest and the settling in the land, some of these Midianites who have come along are blessed, and blessed even to be in the among the royal tribe of Judah. Then verses 17 through 21, And Judah went with his brother Simeon, and they attacked the Canaanites who inhabited Zephath and utterly destroyed it. So the name of the city was called Hormah. Also, Judah took Gaza with its territory, Ashkelon with its territory, and Ekron with its territory. So Yahweh was with Judah, and they drove out the mountaineers, but they could not drive out the inhabitants of the lowland because they had chariots of iron. And they gave Hebron to Caleb, as Moses had said. Then he expelled from there the three sons of Anak. But the children of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who inhabited Jerusalem, so the Jebusites dwell with the children of Benjamin in Jerusalem to this day. So here we start to see a transition. It continues sort of as it began. Judah and Simeon go up, they attack the Canaanites at Zephath, they utterly destroy it, and they name the city Hormah, which I think means destroyed. And then they took Gaza with its territory, Ashkelon with its territory, and Ekron with its territory. And then we have this great summary. So Yahweh was with Judah. So far, so good. And then we're told they drove out the mountaineers, which I can't help but think of West Virginia, but I know it has nothing to do with West Virginia, but that's the only mountaineers I know, the University of West Virginia. But they drove out the mountaineers. They drove out those that lived in the mountains, but we're told, and there's the word but is signaling the transition here, but they could not drive out the inhabitants of the lowland because they had chariots of iron. And they gave Hebron to Caleb, as Moses had said. Then he expelled from there the three sons of Anak. But the children of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who inhabited Jerusalem. So the Jebusites dwell with the children of Benjamin in Jerusalem to this day. And here we begin to see what we're going to see much more of in the book of Judges. And that is, along with successes that come with obedience, there's lack of success when people don't follow through on what Yahweh calls them to do. But they could not drive out the inhabitants of the lowland. But the children of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who inhabited Jerusalem. So apparently Judah had gained victory over Jerusalem, had cleansed it by fire, and yet that belonged in the territory of Benjamin. And when Benjamin was there, the Jebusites came back and lived in the city. And again, it's not until David's day that he drives the Jebusites out. And so we see this mixed picture in the first section of the first chapter of Judges. We see the Lord giving a command. We see the Lord giving promises. We see Judah stepping forward as that royal tribe who he calls to lead this mopping up operation in the promised land. We see great success against powerful enemies. But by the time we get closer to the end of the chapter, we're already beginning to see, but they didn't drive these out. But they didn't drive those out. And so we already know that this mopping up operation is not happening in its completeness. And next time, we will visit some of the other tribes and see how they do in terms of their obedience and their success.